Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Professor Mark Kuckelberg, author of Self-Improvement, Technologies of the Soul in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. So it's published by Columbia University Press. It'll be released in mid-July. Mark is the professor of philosophy of media and technology at the University of Vienna. He's written many books about robotics, the ethics of same, but the two that mesh nicely with the new work are AI Ethics and Introduction to the Philosophy of Technology. He's the former president of the Society for Philosophy and Technology, by the way. Have we been so obsessed with self-improvement that this $11 billion industry has become toxic, in that the obsession has led to an actual turning away from the self and embracing outside encouragement, apology, and excuse, and kind of almost in an egotistical way, which is not the way you want to go? Like the ancient philosophers that Professor talks about in the book, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and more modern ones, Nietzsche, Wittgenstein, and others advise, let's just take a close look at ourselves. And as Socrates suggested, know thyself. Not navel gazing, but an effort to understand what drives us, how morality, and in this case, technology, can create a fine template for epistemological and metaphysical inner knowledge. Not necessarily the seat of human consciousness, and the possibility, as I know and he knows, that with quantum computers, even this week, they've come up with something that theoretically is 180 million times faster than the fastest supercomputer. So it's not the idea that a quantum computer could simulate the entire universe like a Turing machine, but a more prosaic, if you will, approach to the individual, that individual being you. So welcome, Mark, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
So I guess we should get some definitions down before we start. And the best way to do that, I think, is by parsing, you know, deconstructing the title and the subtitle of the book. So people have an idea, but what is self-improvement? What is the obsession? And what's wrong with, say, losing weight, stopping smoking, getting a better job? What's wrong with those aspects of self-improvement? And what's the other aspect you're talking about that may be problematic?
Yeah. Self-improvement is an idea that's ancient, as you already suggested, and I think it's in itself a very good idea. It's about, for example, the ancients recommended to have more self-discipline, self-control. Nowadays, we indeed try to live more healthy. We try to improve our relationships to others, and so on. And I think that's in principle, very good thing. I think what I take issue with in the book is the obsessive character of it, the culture that forces us to improve ourselves, culture also that focuses on that self, on the ego, rather than having a more relational view of the self. It's a culture also that's highly commercialized. So, you know, it's good to improve yourself, but if that means that you can only improve yourself if you buy products XYZ, if you buy these services, if you watch these movies and so on, then we get into a very different kind of atmosphere. And I think that's the atmosphere we're in now, that people are obsessively busy with it. They are buying all kind of stuff and believe that it improves their lives. But in fact, it can lead to the opposite. It can lead to less well-being and flourishing once it gets so obsessive and once it gets so much focused on the self as opposed to relating to others.
Okay, well, then that's a good lead into the second half of the title, which is what's going to be intriguing and perhaps confusing, which is good. As a bookseller, that's a good title because it says, you know, oh, this looks interesting. So the idea is then, how in the world does technology and the soul, two seemingly disparate things, how does technology and the soul interface with the idea of creating a for want of a better word, a better you.
Exactly. Yeah. Let me start with technology. I think we use technologies nowadays to improve ourselves. Like we try to do it by social media. We try to do it by tracking ourselves with all kinds of apps. For example, when we sport, we keep our food patterns. We quantify ourselves by means of all these technologies. And that can lead to a very particular way of looking at humans and ourselves as this like collection of data, as data producers, as bunch of quantified data. So that I'm critical about that. And interestingly, technologies are also sometimes used for spiritual purposes. Instead of doing years of training, for example, Buddhist meditation or similar, people want fast track enlightenment. People want spiritual progress, but they want to have it fast, and they use technologies for that. And with new neurotechnologies, with all kind of techniques that use also AI. We can actually try to get in different brain states and try to reach what normally takes years. Of course, I'm also critical of that. I think it's again a sort of consumption way of looking at religion in this case, or at reaching different levels of consciousness, reaching enlightenment. So I'm interested in what happens there. How and why do people use this? What do they want to reach with it? How did they fail with it? And in what kind of culture does that fit, right? In this culture of techno-solutionism, where we always think that for every problem, there should be a technological fix, rather than also looking at other solutions and at maybe slower but more beneficial ways, both for ourselves and others, to reach these goals.
It's funny, when you mentioned Buddhism, I think of the concept of spiritual materialism, which is kind of what you're talking about. And the interesting thing about the bookstore is, I have my self-improvement section and I don't really like it. But then you also say, the apps we use, the workshops we go to, the speakers, motivational or otherwise, retreats, yeah. Silent meditation, which harkens back actually to your monastery stuff, but and life hacks. And I hate the word hacks.
Right.
So should everyone just give up all those things? What should they not go see whatever his name is, Tony Robbins, that kind of thing?
I think there's, people should not give up improving themselves, but I think they should see the limitations of using that kind of method. So, if what you want to do is buy that book, go to that workshop, watch a video of these people, then by all means do it. But I think it's good to realize that these kind of methods do not necessarily change your whole life. And we also require a lot of hard work from yourself, with your mind, with your body, and won't do the trick as fast as a consumer product is supposed to do, or as fast as a click on a website is supposed to do. So I think it's about maybe finding some more moderation with that kind of products and services, and maybe shifting focus, right, from trying to find that quick solution to really going, embarking on a longer journey of improving yourself, which is slower and perhaps will lead to a lot of failures, and will also involve a more open view, a view that's less self-focused, but it's more about the main goal shouldn't be self-improvement, but improvement of others or improvement of the world around you, which might bring self-improvement on the way. So we should think about that. I don't have the magic solution either there, but I think we should see the limitations of this obsessive focus with the self, and using this technological and commercial means as the only and quick fix.
Well, so, you know, it's really great the way you bring in all the philosophers that people have. Some readers will be very conversant, some readers will just be learning, and it'll be good because then they'll go, as I have for some of the philosophers like Lovelock. He's not really a philosopher, but I didn't know who he was, and then looking him up and learning a lot more about it, which was really good. But if you go back to Socrates, you know, the idea of know thyself, and then whoever said the unexamined life is not worth living. Okay, I guess a cynic might say, well, what good does that do you? Know thyself. What good, how does that go towards improvement? Because you seem to like the idea.
I do like the idea. I do think that of course, examining one's life and philosophical reflection is not the only thing we should do. We should also care about our body, about our health, and so on. We should not only engage in sort of cognitive stuff, but I think what Socrates got right is that it's worth reflecting on your own life, on what you really want, on how you can improve your life, philosophy offers ways to do that, offers also some ideas to do that. But it's not like, you know, you can summarize this in a few one-liners or build that into a product and then all is done. It's actually a kind of lifelong difficult process where you slowly get to know yourself and get to know yourself also through others, through your interactions with the world. And I think what's wrong with many self-improvement products and services now is that they kind of pretend that you can, so to speak, take a blue pill or a red pill or whatever it is, and things are, you know, done for you. Or things go very fast, and that's simply not the case.
Well, now we have this helper AI, and I wouldn't bring up robotics necessarily, but that's part of your expertise. And you read about philosophy of robotics, ethics of robotics, which reminds me of Isaac Asimov and the three laws of robotics, which is don't harm any human being, follow instructions, and make sure you stay intact. But there's this zeroth law, which is, as you said, protect mankind. Don't let anything bad happen to mankind. Like the Gaia prop, you talk about that, Gaia. So I guess that would be, if you're truly enlightened, I don't know, would the sole mission of your life be simply to protect and enhance and preserve, as you suggest in your closing, mankind? You know, you can talk about utilitarianism and Hume and Bentham and John Stuart Mill. Is part of your thesis that perhaps we should look more at preserving our own society and the earth itself?
I think it's good to see ourselves as relational, also in the sense that we are living on this planet and connected to all these ecosystems, and we are part of humankind. So I think it's a good goal to try to contribute to improving things also for the bigger whole. It's a good thing to relate to the larger context we're part of. Now, the problem with utilitarianism is that it can become a more sort of alienated, abstract way of relating to the world, where you're kind of, you know, again, have a kind of recipe that, as a philosopher king, as a you know, kind of almost authoritarian person, want to impose on the world, say, like, you know, improve mankind, improve humankind, but you know, forget about individual beings. So there are people who think about the future of humanity in those terms. There are people who think that we should prioritize the hypothetical lives of future generations in such a way that lives today don't count so much, for example. So it's a kind of dangerous thing, I think, to think only about the whole. But what is good, I think, is to see ourselves as part of the whole, see ourselves as part of society, of communities, and indeed of the living ecosystems of this planet. And so I think it is good to improve those things. Also, I have that as a goal, because the improvement of ourselves, I think, is intrinsically connected to improving our environment, our ecological environment, our also even the political environment, so that we increase human flourishing, but in a way that starts with that more relational and engaged way of relating to the outside world, rather than thinking that as a philosopher with one formula you can improve the world and that's it.
One of the things that's helpful for you and everybody else is that, and you bring it out very clearly in the book, is that we stand on the shoulders of these giants like Aristotle and Wittgenstein, and it gives you mixing metaphors, it gives you a leg up. But then, for our readers, and if we have this in the nonfiction book club, they will argue back and forth because, for example, Wittgenstein, the world is what we make of it. And then you go, language is technology, and technology is language. It's like kind of solipsistic. And then, so that's going to confuse the reader, because he's going to think, wait a minute, you're talking about actually rolling your sleeves up like mine are and working. And then you're talking about, wait a minute, how do I even know that reality exists? It's almost solipsistic. And so you're talking about the concept of improving in conjunction with technology, but then you're also talking about something that people can't really get a handle on. If language is technology and technology is language, and you can't separate subject from object, that's really confusing.
Yeah, it can be confusing. And I think that Wittgenstein there, the way that you talked about his ideas can be taken in a sort of Cartesian solipsistic way, that we focus on ourselves and doubt the world around us. I think that's not the way it should be read. I think from Wittgenstein and other philosophers of language, we can really learn how important language is in shaping the world. And that's really, a significant breakthrough in philosophy. But for me, that language, which is indeed a technology, is like all technologies, is related to humans, and it's related to the world. Maybe there is not a sort of one-to-one representation of the world in language. Language is indeed, that is much more active. It's much more constructing that world also. But it's part of a wider process, and humans are part of the process, and other elements are part of that. So I see technologies and humans as part of this more ecological and processual world, where things are changing and where language influences the world, but the world also, is related to that language. So I think we, this is a huge topic, but for me, language as a technology means also to embed language in the world, and to see how it shapes that world.
I was just thinking while you're talking about that, and maybe you can tell from my questions, perhaps learning to think before you speak might be a really good way of self-improvement. And it's true, AI is able to do that. Human beings have a very difficult time of actually processing information before they spout out some nonsense, which you get into to a certain extent in the socioeconomic aspect, the political aspect of the world today, and how absurd and evil and nasty it is. But It's true. I hadn't thought about it that way before, but I think if you could process, evaluate before you actually provided information to the world in the form of language, that might be a form of self-improvement.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can learn from philosophy to indeed think before we speak. And in this world, that's not really always appreciated, right? One has to be quick, one has to perform. And those who cannot perform on the spot, those who fail to, you know, spit out words immediately, are often disregarded or are neglected even. I think this world is a world that often benefits people who are extrovert, people who are ready to perform without thinking too much. And I think philosophers teach that it's good to argue, to reason, to discuss things, and I think that they help us to lead better lives in that way. I also think they can help us to lead better, to shape better relationship with others, because instead of immediately reacting to someone, for example, in a way that shows negative emotions, it encourages us to be these reflective beings and think about things, also put ourselves in a place of someone else. Philosophers normally, if you do it well, philosophy, you learn to also see the arguments of other people, to even think up the arguments of other people, so you can better shape your own view. I think those are skills that are generally very, very helpful to humanity. And I think philosophy, you know, used to be regarded as something that was not very useful, not very relevant. But in fact, the contrary is the case, I think. And I think we need philosophy and humanities today to help make sense of the world and to also indeed improve things. But it's not the improvement that, you know, comes with, you know, quickly reading one book or a few quotes from famous philosophers. It's also a process that takes time.
Yeah, I think your last line in the book, I think, is, you know, something like, we need technologies that tell different and better stories about ourselves, and better selves will then emerge. But the problem I see with it is, like, for example, American politics and one politician in particular. When he speaks, he's speaking, spouting nonsense. There's nothing empirical about it. There's no epistemological aspect of his speech. Mm-hmm. Yet, half of Americans follow him as sheep. And so, yeah, you're saying we need technology. How in God's name am I supposed to, what is my involvement supposed to be, or other Americans, or in right-wing countries like Greece that just had its election? How are we supposed to do what you wanted? You're saying academically, you tell me what the process would be to move towards a goal like that.
Yeah. I think this, what the things you're talking about are very worrying, very concerning. And I'm currently writing on AI and democracy, because I'm so worried about this kind of, partly because I'm worried about this kind of phenomena. I think the for me, the magic word there is education. Now, it's easily said, and it's not so easy to spell out exactly what we need. But something like an education where you learn the kind of critical skills that philosophers have, where you learn to question the evidence, to question the facts, where you learn to deal with texts, for example, from ChatGPT, or indeed learn to deal with the words that are almost thrown up by some of these politicians. I think that is something that we can teach people. We can learn to do better on that. So we need some kind of citizen education, civic education, And that's an old idea, also again from ancient times, has been taken up in the Renaissance and then later developed also by Enlightenment philosophers until in you know 20th century in the American context. John Dewey, I think, developed some very interesting ideas about that. So I think the intellectual heritage is there to do something about education. Whether it's politically feasible to really radically improve our education and build in that civic and, you know, civilizing element also is another question. But I think that's the sort of direction we need to move. And I would really wish my American friends to go move more in that direction.
Yeah, it's like kind of talking about Pico and his 900 theses, and that's what ChatGPT, he wanted to be ChatGPT. So like, yep.
Right.
But what I was saying in the introduction, look how fast it's moving. You know, you go, everyone in the world knows ChatGPT. 6 months ago, no one knew what it was. Then it was 3.5. Now it's 4.0. It stopped in September of 2021. This other one, Inflection Pi, it goes current because it's actually connected to the internet, which ChatGPT isn't. So how do you think the ancients would feel about having access to essentially all the knowledge they needed to have in order to live their lives? I mean, I asked ChatGPT about you, and I got a pretty good summary, which helped me in my research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this kind of technologies should not be banned or anything. I think we should use them, make good use of them, but we should also be aware of the limitations, the possibility, for example, that they suddenly come up with complete nonsense. We should really exercise these kind of digital skills, kind of, you know, develop a kind of digital humanism where we are, you know, not only looking at books in a critical way and learning to deal with that, learning to read in a critical way, but where we also learn to deal with technologies and media of today, you know, as great tools also to connect people and to have intellectual conversations, but also tools that are not perfect and yeah, you know, epistemic environments that are polluted by people who on purpose spread misinformation and nonsense, but also, you know, quite naturally, you know, there will be always noise, there will be always information that's not correct. So I think we need to also learn to deal with that. We can try to improve the technologies, but we also need that education to, you know, deal with it in a critical way. And I'm not against technology at all. I think we should absolutely reap the benefits of them. Usually the emphasis is then on economic gain. I think we should especially reap the benefits in terms of human well-being and flourishing. I think they can contribute to better lives, but we should develop that critical attitude, because otherwise we will be and are just victim of people who use the technologies for these bad purposes, but also we're victims of the, you know, all the unintended bad effects of every medium and technology that comes to us. And I think one start for that is to realize that technologies are not neutral, that media are not just these tools, but that with those media and tools come ways of seeing the world, ways of perceiving the world, ways of seeing it ourselves and others. And I think once we realize that they're also, you know, human and cultural and for, you know, ethically and politically loaded, that then we can begin to have a discussion about, like, what kind of technology and media do we want? What kind of world do we want? What kind of role can this particular technology play in that?
Well, you said you were worried. I'm naturally, for good or for bad, a pessimist. And I see things moving so quickly. And then, you know, if you look at the letter that was signed by all the AI people, let me ask you this, like, bluntly, would you have signed that letter had you been asked, given your expertise?
I didn't sign that letter that asked for a break. I think it was a letter that was created by a very specific group of people who have specific ideas about the future of humanity, and also people who have vested interest in perhaps having some confusion about these technologies, but who at the same time very much invest in them. I think this was a very political kind of move, and what we need instead of this kind of big fears and doom thinking is to rather look at the very specific ethical issues and political challenges that come with the technologies, and not ban them or pause innovation, but rather think about how can we regulate these technologies in a way that shapes the innovation in a good way, that also is more democratic, because what we now have is that our technological future, and therefore the society's future of our societies, is really determined by a few CEOs and owners of big tech companies. And I think that's something, that a situation that we, we all respect for the need for entrepreneurship. I think it's a situation that we cannot tolerate in a democratic society. So we need to do something about that. And you're also very right about the speed of developments. In 2018, I was part of this high-level expert group that advised the European Commission on AI, regulating AI. Only next year, we will really have the implementation of the legal framework that came out of that. I think this is going far too slow, and this is, at the moment, the fastest process we had is the first big robust legislation. So I think we need to do something also about that. We need to, as a society, be able to react faster to the fast technological changes. Think maybe about new institutions that can react faster. Because speed is a problem, is a big challenge, and we need to tackle that.
Yeah, and for those who aren't familiar with your previous work, it's 2019, which in technology seems like a century ago now. Really does. 2019, you wrote AI Ethics. So that's what we're talking about, is ethics. So for those who don't know, what was the central theme then, and would it be the same now, of the ethical implications of AI?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say back then there has been a lot of emphasis on developing trustworthy AI, and trustworthy AI was basically a synonym for ethical AI. And ethical AI was, the idea was that humans stay in control, and that humans stay responsible for AI. And that's still, of course, a concern today. But I think with the new developments, ChatGPT, also before suddenly AI can create art and things like that, I think what we realize now is that the impact on society is much bigger than many people thought. And I think that we will move in directions where people start understanding that these technologies are indeed quite invasive and quite quite a lot changing our world. I think before AI was still, it was already hyped a bit, but it wasn't, I think, the general public wasn't really aware so much of the risks and the challenges. I think now that's changing, and I think it's an opportunity to think together about how are we going to deal now. It's AI. What the next thing will come in a few years? How are we going to deal with new technologies in our society? It's a question people like me think about already for 20, 25 years, but I think it's now a question that's more imminent, that's more pertinent for today. So I hope that that these developments also lead to positive changes in that direction, that we create better ways of dealing with new and emerging technologies.
Yeah, well, kind of going back to Asimov's rules of robotics, the idea is, to me, AI, like, you know, whether it's Elon Musk saying it's a more pressing problem than climate change or nuclear, well, let's talk about nuclear weapons. No one's used them since we used them, but they still scare everybody. Right now, what you're suggesting, I think, is, you know, that we continue to protect ourselves with algorithms and AI that preclude it, that preclude AI from harming us. But once someone, some bad actor gets a hold of the technology, he can easily take that fail-safe mechanism off. And that's what scares me.
Yeah, I think there are risks in that sense, but we shouldn't think too much about AI. You know, there are cybersecurity risks. There are, of course, also military uses and so on. But I think the AI we should worried about today mainly is the AI that we don't always see, the AI that's behind the screen, that, you know, when we use internet and digital social media, there are search engines that are, like, we are being profiled, our data are analyzed and so on. I think this kind of AI is potentially very dangerous because it can be used to manipulate people for both political purposes and for commercial purposes. And we have to watch out that we don't move to a society where we are, you know, profiled and treated like lab rats and manipulated and experimented with in that sense. Because that undermines, I think, the ideals that we inherited from the Enlightenment, for example. You know, we want to be autonomous beings. We want to be, you know, having some control and some say over our lives, over what we think and believe, over what we feel, and so on. And I think with the possibilities of AI are now such that, yeah, we can be very easily manipulated, but our thoughts and feelings, and that's going to be a big issue, I think, in the coming years. And then I find that the issues about, yeah, who gets hold of the technology to do what, I think that's probably not the most important risk.
It's funny that when you go back to the philosophers, which is a really fascinating aspect of the book. So you're talking about Sartre and freedom. You were just talking about freedom. You know, Sartre's kind of saying freedom is, like, really scary. Freedom is a really scary thing to have. It may be the scariest thing to have. And so there's a paradox in what you're saying.
Absolutely. I think it's a huge problem. And I dealt with it a little bit in my book, called Green Leviathan, where I bring up this scenario, like, what if there is this sort of benign dictator who, for the good of humanity, takes away the freedom and argues that we should use AI to govern humanity. For the benefit of humanity, and of course, I'm critical of that. It's also kind of utilitarian reasoning. It's a kind of, it's an authoritarian use of AI, of course. So we don't want that. But the reason why I use the example, and I go back to Dostoevsky, to the Brothers Karamazov, where there's the Grand Inquisitor making a similar argument, like, people are, you know, don't want freedom, so let's rule them. I think this kind of, we should take serious the, you know, the temptation in a way and the challenge, because the more AI gets powerful and better in what it does, the more there will be the temptation of, you know, the powerful people in the world, powerful corporations, powerful governments to use this tool to, you know, to try to improve us, to come back to improvement, in the name of, you know, doing good, in the name of improving people. So I think that's something that we should be aware of, that this is a danger, and because it goes against our fundamental values and human rights. And it's I think it's a direction we should by all means avoid, while recognizing that, you know, some influencing of the choices people make is probably needed in the light of climate change, in the light of dealing with a lot of problems in this world. But that's a different, difficult problem, a difficult challenge, I think, once AI enables all these possibilities.
It harkens almost all the way back to Plato's Republic, you know?
That's right. Plato argued that we should have the guardians that are, you know, that know what to do, that know what is good for us, and that we should give them the steering wheel. Well, I think that's not what we want, but we should really think about what we want instead. That's in the upcoming book.
Let's ask the question, right?
Yeah.
I was going to ask you. Well, first of all, I think it boils down to you're optimistic and I'm pessimistic. But as we close, and that was a good segue to it, is talk a little bit about what this coming work is, and then we can sign off.
Yeah. I am working on the question about AI and democracy. Like, what is AI doing to democracy? And I see all kind of risks there. But I also use it as an opportunity to ask the question, like, okay, what is democracy then? What kind of democracy do we want? Do we want a system where, you know, people just vote every so many years, which we have now, and vote for, you know, the most, you know, silly person there is? Is that democracy? Right? Or do we want something else? And so that takes me on a journey about democracy. And just as self-improvement is not just about technology, but about what is that self then, and what is improvement of that self? I ask the question, what kind of democracy do we want? What is a good kind of politics? I think this, that's the beauty, I think, also about these debates that are about technology, is that it brings up the big, often ancient philosophical questions, which are not only interesting academically, but which are just simply the big questions for us as persons and as societies. And that's what I'm interested in. And that's what I think philosophers can contribute a little bit to. So I'll keep writing those books.
Yeah, I think it's great that you're writing them. I wouldn't want to undertake it, because you're going to have to be writing until the day that the book comes out, because everything actually is moving that fast. You know?
Oh, yeah, that's a problem.
It's the problem. Yeah. Which are actually printing the pages and look, your book isn't even out yet. You got a month to go or 3 weeks.
Exactly. And in the meantime, lots of things happen. People say things about democracy and so on. Yeah. It's always a little bit behind in that sense, but it also provides some stability, of course. Right. So I try to write them in a way that they can still be used in a couple of years.
Yeah. And you have. Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you today about your book, and I look forward to it coming out and having it in the bookshop.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.